Test. This is Dave Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute, and today is September 22nd, 1987. And we are in the spacious downtown office of Roy D. Chapin, Jr., and today we're continuing his account of his reminiscences of the days with Hudson, and especially the latter part of his career with American Motors. We'll ask Mr. Chapin to pick up the narrative about the time of his father's death and about the time of his coming into the company. If we could, perhaps, Mr. Chapin, if we could. How you felt when you began to move up in the hierarchy?
Well, I think we covered some of this, but as I believe I said to you before, Dave, he was a very busy man all his life. He was tremendously interested in business and in his governmental and civic activities, which were manifold. He was, as you recall, I'm sure that he was the Secretary of Commerce under President Hoover back at in the days of the depths of the Depression, when one of his most frustrating responsibilities was to go around and try to convince the world, or at least the United States, that prosperity was just around the corner. And that took a heavy toll of him. There's no question in my mind about that. All this while, so of course I didn't see him with great regularity.
I was at Yale.
I was at Yale, yes. He returned to become the president, I believe it was, or the chairman certainly, of Hudson back in after his term as Secretary of Commerce, which would have been about probably the spring of 1933. Mm-hmm. And he shepherded, you might say, the introduction of the Terraplane, and then in 34, 5, and 6, the switch over to the completely new models which Hudson had at that time. The company was, you know, as was every other auto company at that time, was in pretty tough shape because there wasn't any business. It was almost an impossibility to build a car at a price that people first could afford, and secondly, that you could make any money at as a company. So, to make a long story short, in February of 36, he contracted pneumonia and died very suddenly. In fact, it happened literally overnight, and I was in college in New Haven, and had to, in those days, get on a train and come back to Detroit. And it was a very big shock to, of course, to the whole family, because he had been such an active and person, not only as an individual in business, but also as a member of the family, as a father. And so actually I never had any experience in terms of working in Hudson or working for him in any capacity, other than a couple of summertime jobs in the engineering department, and then I didn't go to work for Hudson until 1938, because I graduated in 37 and I tried a year of just in the financial world, which didn't satisfy me.
What was your undergraduate major?
I majored in business administration, and took a lot of what turned out to be very useful courses, accounting and things like that, which, you know, were not normal, or normal is maybe the wrong word, not usual in those days. And for example, engineering drawing, which taught me not only to draw but also to be able to read blueprints and that sort of thing, which all at one time I had the idea that I was going to be an architect, which is one of the reasons I started out with these illusions, and that changed. So But all that, so if any college career really can prepare you for business, I probably came as close to it as you could, at least in the 30s. So that's the lead up to the point when I did start to work for the Hudson Company, Hudson Motor Car Company, in 1938. My first job was as a mechanic and a test driver, which in those days was a very informal kind of procedure. We had no elaborate proving grounds or test tracks or anything like that. We just stayed east of Woodward Avenue. That was kind of the basic rule, and we had up at Imlay City in the Thumb a sort of a big filling station there, a gasoline station at which we would gather sometime in the course of the day for lunch, usually. It was quite an interesting arrangement because the drivers were real characters. They were, most of them were fellows who, like Al Miller and Chet Miller, who would drive for Hudson during the year, and then they'd run down about a week ahead of Indianapolis and drive the Indianapolis race, which, you know, now that's such a specialized thing that I guess it's inconceivable that somebody would live that way. But they were a very attractive bunch of guys because they were very macho, but they had great senses of humor. They were mostly sort of, my impression is they were mostly had still true today, I guess, but a lot of Southern blood in them. Mm-hmm. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I was a junior member of most of those teams, and so I usually, when we had a run involving, let's say, springs on a gravel road where you had to eat dust all day long, I always got the tail car. And those are all the kind of things that added up to that at my age then. It was a hell of a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And when the system was quite simple, if you took a car out and tested it until something broke, and then you had it towed in, and you called somebody up and they came and got you, and then you and the mechanic that had been assigned to you would lie under the car or whatever was necessary until you took out the busted pieces, and then the engineers analyzed them and tried to determine what needed to be changed or improved or mm-hmm. whatever. Yeah. So it was a kind of a relatively carefree life, and I must say when the day came that I was moved out of that to other responsibilities, I kind of sort of regretted it because I was only 22 or 3 years old.
Hudson have a pace car during these years at the
Yes, but I believe it was prior to that time. I'm trying to remember. I can remember the car, and
it must have been terrible.
The Terraplanes were we used primarily. We did a lot of speed work with them, and we did some Pikes Peak hill climbs and things of that nature. Right. In fact, I owned the one that broke the Pikes Peak record. It came back in, and it was sitting around, and I made an offer to buy it, and they were kind enough to sell it to me with the help of my father in terms of the financial aspects of it. And that was a lot of fun because, of course, it had the big lettering all over the door, and in those days, that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. We did have a pace car, and I'm trying to remember what year it was because I remember working on the car, but I don't recall. I've never been to Indianapolis, so I had nothing to do with the actual running of it.
The Pike Peak apparently was 32, I think.
That was when they were trying to establish the right. tremendous performance capabilities of the Terraplane,
right.
which it had compared to most anything else at that time.
Well, the nice thing about, if there's anything nice about a father's death, is that he left the company in pretty good shape. In spite of the Depression, he had shepherded the Terraplane into existence.
And 36 was a profitable year.
Exactly, yeah.
And, but it was a nice change. I think 35 was minimally profitable.
Mm-hmm.
36, in those days, as I remember, they made something like $6 million, which sounded like a whole lot of money then.
It was.
And it was. And 37 continued profitable. Then the whole economy got into trouble in the late 30s, as you recall,
38
recession.
Yeah.
And things got a lot more, things became sort of touch and go until the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, back up a little bit, if I may. We talked last time about the legendary Frank Spring. What was your first contact with him? Did you have any contact at all when you were a trainee or?
Yeah, I used to see him, and we were sort of attracted to one another because he was a very, very interesting man and a very mercurial in a sense,
mm-hmm.
But we, when I was working in the engineering department, well, after I ceased being driving most of the time, I saw, and I don't know exactly how it started, to tell you the truth, except we were both interested in old automobiles, mm-hmm. and he had a motorcycle and an airplane, and we used to fly down, well, for example, we'd fly down to Watkins Glen for the sports car SCCA races in his airplane, which is a terrifying experience, I can tell you, because he was a takeoff no matter what kind of a guy. Anyway, we used to have lunch together quite regularly, and I really thoroughly enjoyed Frank. We became good personal friends, because he loved the same kind of things I did. He liked mm-hmm. to fish, and he liked to hunt, and he belonged to a club up in northern Michigan that he used to fly up to. And, mm-hmm. and anyway, he was one of the real stars of that whole organization.
Yeah. Well, he left a remarkable legacy, I think, in terms of really a far-seeing design value.
Well, he's attributed with the, and certainly being one of the people, perhaps the primary one, to develop that so-called step-down design, the unitized construction,
right.
which became, which was the case in the 48,
mm-hmm. right.
Hudson,
with, yeah.
which became the Hornet, which became very successful mm-hmm. in most every way, both as a commercial product and also, of course, as a stock car.
Remember the design staff at all in those days? Do you remember a young designer named Bob Cotto? Who,
I remember that name. I don't remember.
He later went on to Studebaker to work for Lowy and then on to Ford. And interviewed him recently. He said his time at Hudson was most enjoyable, especially working for Frank Spring.
Genius. Yeah, I think I've had some contact with him years ago, but old car project or something. Well, the chief engineer at that time was Stuart Bates, who subsequently became the executive vice president, and then Miller Tonkray sort of really was the day-by-day engineering chief. There was a fellow named Jim Gregg who did the it was sort of a trio that was quite a fascinating the way it worked. Spring would dream up the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Gregg would figure out how to make the thing practical, or Gregg,
yes.
and I've forgotten what his title was, but he would figure out how to make it commercial, let's say, and then a fellow named Joe Eskridge would figure out how to make it manufacturable.
Mm-hmm.
He was the third leg of that stool, and they were a great team together because each had completely different types of talent. And they all got along very well, and they were all extremely bright fellows. But Eskridge subsequently went on to run the special products division, and in fact, I worked for him at one part of the time during the war when he ran all our aircraft operations.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell me a bit about these people in context of what you just said. Mr. A.E. Barrett, do you remember working with him?
I remember working for him.
For him, yes, right. I'm sorry. He succeeded your father, did he not?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. He had come up through the procurement end of the business. He was a purchasing agent,
mm-hmm.
and a very good one. He also had very fine financial understanding. He was mm-hmm. a good finance man, and he was a very reserved, very gentlemanly, very complex person.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a fair amount of time with him. We had a period that was not exactly a very pleasant one, because there was a point back in the history when the Fishers decided they might like to buy the Hudson Motor Car Company, and they were talking to the Chapins and other people like us who owned substantial amounts of stock, and we sided with them, and we had a rather acrimonious annual meeting at which, through some legal techniques, the thing was declared invalid, and so the net result of it all was that Barrett obviously considered this was antagonistic to him, and it was, mm-hmm. when you get right down to it, because it probably would have removed him as the head of the company. But mm-hmm. although that was not the objective.
No.
The objective was to get the Fishers active in the company.
Sure. Yeah.
And so for quite a few years, I had a Well, first of all, I had a very tough decision to make. Should I stay with the company? Because I was in a very insignificant position at that time.
Mm-hmm. And you had inherited the family stock, some of the family stock.
Well, I didn't have it personally, but it existed in some trusts, yes. Mm-hmm. And we did have a representative on the board, my mother's brother, my uncle. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it was a very difficult period there for a while. And I decided that you know, the easy thing would have been to just check out, because there were plenty of alternatives. But I decided I really liked the business, and I might as well try to sweat it through and see what happened. So,
if you were your father's namesake, and it seemed logical. That
yeah, well, it was, but it was at that, you know, I was young, and at that age, there were a lot of other things that looked pretty good too. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, Barrett and I were not exactly, we didn't spend a lot of time talking to one another. Mm-hmm. For quite a while, then bit by bit, that seemed to get better. And toward the end, which is certainly to his credit, he, in effect, decided, well, maybe this is okay. And he used to go on, well, I would go with him and a group on these various sales missions where you'd address a bunch of dealers. And he was always somewhat ill at ease when he had to speak to people. And so a lot of times the sales boys were all very busy with all their contacts, and so they'd kind of, I'd spend more time with him than anybody else, because a lot of them, frankly, they had a lot of their own problems and they didn't want to be distracted. So this happened for a year and a couple of years maybe, and I got to know him much better in the course of that. And as I said, he and I always, of course, recognized that my father had seen in him great talent, mm-hmm. which he had.
Mm-hmm. He'd been with him since 1910, I see.
Yeah, literally. I think he started, as I said, in the purchasing department in some capacity.
Mm-hmm. It was stenographer in purchasing.
Was that it?
Yeah. To a man named Benzer. Or Besner.
Fred Besner, who was one of the original group that started the company. Well, anyway, as time passed, the merger with Nash surfaced, and after having tried some other alternatives, which Barrett recognized were inevitable, there was a talk about Nash and Biggert Hudson all going together, you know, that kind of stuff, and that was one that was just impossible to put all four in one package.
Sure.
But anyway, when Mason came along with his proposal, I remember at that time I had been elected to the Hudson Motor Car Board. I was assistant sales manager, I think, which was sort of inappropriate, but my uncle had withdrawn from the board and I was sort of the only alternative. And so when the word came down that, I'll never forget, I was in Denver and I got a phone call from Barrett saying Mason wants to talk about putting the two companies together. Do you have any opinions, or would you like to come back into, I was in Denver, as I said, I would come back into Detroit and talk about it. I just said, no, do it. And he hung up on me. He didn't think that was very discreet of me. However, I did get on an airplane, go back to Detroit, and we had a board meeting, and one thing led to another. And he stayed on. He and I were the two people who, survived, who were continued on the American Motors board that were Hudson people. And then he saw that he was not going to have anything really to say about running the company, so he withdrew from the board after a period of about, I think, less than a year.
Uh-huh. But he was a major influence in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, very definitely, very definitely. He was it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he worked with your father long enough so there was a continuity there of your father's policies. They'd sort of worked closely together in the 20s and 30s.
And then, as I say, he faced that, the war period was a and in some ways it was a savior because the company made some money, not much, but some. I don't think we performed as well as we might on a couple of contracts, but that's neither did anybody else as far as that goes.
Right.
Because I always like to, you know, if you said you're going to have something done by a certain time, you ought to have it. But mm-hmm. There were so many obstacles to, you know, in terms of procurement and quality of people and all the rest of it. It was a nightmare
and
that period.
Of parts too was a big,
yeah.
I'm sure a big thing. I'd like to talk to you about that period and, of course, about the merger later, but can I move you back again to someone you've mentioned who perhaps was one of your early mentors, Stuart Gregory Bates. Was he pretty much a force in the engineering earlier, at least early in your career there?
Let's say he was a brain, because he's just one of the smartest men you ever met.
Really?
Yeah, and a wonderful man. I had great admiration for him. He's a very diffident sort of personality. I mean, he doesn't come on very strong. He's a shy man, and you know, we had a substantial age difference, to say nothing of responsibility difference. And so I didn't see a great deal of him. I mean, we never sort of, we never lunched together or did things like that. And and his primary interest was photography, I mean, other than his business. Yeah, he was a very ardent, he was everywhere he went. He, he had a little beret and a camera around his neck. And he was a tall, good-looking, you know, a very impressive man. And as I say, a perfectly wonderful man. But we never became particularly good personal friends for a lot of reasons. Namely, age, responsibility level, et cetera, et cetera.
And also, he apparently moved out of the engineering area, per se, about the time you came on.
Yes, yeah, he was sort of the engineering reported to him as the executive vice president, is my, the way I remember it. And but he always had been an engineer, and he spent a great deal of time in the engineering department, and he was over in that building, probably much more than he was in the office building.
So then, as you noted earlier, he became first vice president in 1936. Had been a director since 1929. That's quite an honor for.
Really, I didn't realize that myself.
Right. And also in 1938, he paced the start of the Indianapolis 500 in an Ivory Hudson convertible.
That's the car I was trying to remember, because that's the car I worked on. We had to put a little jump seat in the back of that, as I remember, because they took somebody along as a. Observer or something. No, but actually, during the and also we had to do quite a few things to the automobile to make it go fast enough, because it was that Hudson was not distinguished for its performance, but apparently we got away with it. But I do recall the little cream-colored automobile, and. But I'm glad you reminded me. That's that. You know, I ought to spend more time reading the history. You know more about the company than I do.
I've just been reviewing the recent.
Is that John?
This is an Automobile Quarterly. Dick Langer's lovely article.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I have that.
He has some delightful things to say. He said that Bates was an outdoor type, as you have said. He was fond of football, hunting, fishing, and motorboats, fine guns, and cameras.
Well, he's kept the hunting and the fine guns at least a secret from me. Boating, yes. And Barrett was a great boater. He loved to go out on the lake.
Did he?
Yeah, that was one of his real joy. And he was a very man of very sophisticated tastes in terms of music and art and things of that nature that Barrett was. That he appreciated the refinements of life, and he was, you know, he was beautifully dressed and all that sort of thing. Bates was much more sort of casual. He was. You know, he'd be in a sport coat and that sort of thing. But he was a camera nut, and if he had any interest in the shooting and fishing end of the world, it was not apparent.
You're quoted as saying, as you said earlier, that he was a genius.
He really was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that he
perfectly remarkable man.
He was very shy, very attractive person when you got to know him. His successor was a man named H.M. Northrop. Do you remember him?
Very well, very well.
What do you remember about him?
He was also a very sort of retiring and very intelligent man. Charming personality, just, you know, just as gentle and gentlemanly, and talked in a very low voice but had a mental process that was just beautiful. I mean, everything flowed in sequence, and I used to see quite a lot of him, particularly because he was the sort of the head. Bates was running during the war. Now this is was running the Naval Ordnance Plant out in Warren, and Northrop was running all the stuff here in Detroit, which I was running. Or I was the production manager for the aircraft end of it, and that was mostly what we did. Was mostly all aircraft, and so I used to see him. I see him quite a lot during that period.
And he ably filled the shoes of Mr. Bates.
I would say so. I never thought of him, if you're speaking the engineering aspects of it, as being sort of on a day-by-day basis an engineer.
Yeah.
I think by that time, Tonkray, whom I mentioned,
how do you spell?
T-O-N-C-R-A-Y, Millard Tonkray was his name. who was really the guy that he sat on top of that engineering department and he ran it, and he was another excellent man.
Well, perhaps we could talk about him in terms of World War II. Spring was, as we said earlier, another Renaissance man. He just seemed to be interested in almost everything.
And he used to have all these wonderful theories, and I tell you the story. Talkery was the realist. This Talkery told me, but I know Spring did it. Spring said to him one day, he said, "You know, I've discovered that if you add water to gasoline, it improves the combustion." Well, everybody knew that because of water injection. But he said, "I discovered you can put it in the tank and it'll work." And Talkery said, "Oh, come on." He said, "Yes." He said, "I've been running a test." And he said, "I've got up to the point where it's 50% gasoline and 50% water in the tank of my car." And he used to do these things. And Talkery said, "Well, that's very interesting, Frank." Frank, he said, and just think of what it'll do for you. I said, "Well, how's the performance?" "Well, the performance really isn't very good. It does stumble a little bit. It doesn't have much acceleration if you get too much water in it." But he said, think of all the gasoline you'd save. Talkery said, "Well, now, did you do anything to check the gasoline mileage on your car when it was running on nothing but gas?" And Spring said, "Yes, I got about 20 miles to the gallon." Talkery said, "Well, now, when you got half water and half gasoline, have you checked how much gasoline consumption you get there?" And Spring said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I haven't." And he said, "Well, why don't you do that?" Spring came back a couple of days later and said, "Well," he said, "I'm glad. I see why you mentioned it." He said, "I'm now getting 10 miles to the gallon." To the gallon in the tank.
Right.
In other words, he's using half as much gasoline and getting half as much mileage. But that was a typical for Springism. He'd go off on a tangent like that. But it was wonderful. There was never a dull moment. He always had something cooking.
Well, I'm really quoting you when you say he had almost limitless imagination. Almost every subject fascinated him. He explored. Both your father and you, apparently, and Frank Spring were interested in aviation.
Yeah, and
your father,
varying
one of the
degrees.
Early
you know.
Members, maybe one of the founders of the Aero Club in Detroit.
That's right. And I was active in the Aero Club.
You were active, and apparently you say here that that Frank Spring had his own, it was one of the first to own an autogyro.
He did. Yeah. I think it's the one that subsequently the Detroit News on. Oh,
is
Lord.
That what we have? We have a Detroit News autogyro.
Well, that's the helicopter.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They did have an autogyro at one time, and Frank owned one, and I have to guess at the timing. I would think it was the late 30s, maybe early 40s, before the war. But he also had his own. He had a Staggerwing Beach, which is a beach biplane that he used to fly around.
That's an acrobatic one.
Well, it seemed like it when he flew it. I'm not sure that it was made for that. It was a version of a commercial private plane, if you want to say that. Call it that. But I remember, I mentioned going down to Watkins Glen, and I remember leaving Watkins Glen, and I'm not kidding you, when we got to the city airport and landed, there was leaves off one of the trees when we took off at Watkins Glen. We cleared them, and we picked up the leaves in the undercarriage.
Oh, no.
And it was that kind of a guy. Finally, I never quit riding with him, but I'd always make sure my insurance policies were intact before I did.
When did you get your pilot's license?
I never had
one. Oh, you never did?
No,
did
I'm
you?
Not a pilot.
Oh, you're not?
No,
I thought you, but you were interested in aviation.
Yeah, and my
and you are a member of the Aero Club there.
Or I was, that's long gone now. Yeah, sure. I was really there. I was more concerned in the Aero Club with trying to get a decent airport for the city of Detroit. That was what I spent most of my time working on. And well, you know, we had one actually right where the Windsor Airport is now. We had a dream of putting a limited access highway, et cetera. Because if you go up over Detroit, and this is like in the 40s, and look down, here's all this on the south side of the river, everything spread in for miles in every direction with all the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And you look across the river, and here's the little town of Windsor, and there's just miles of nothing but open flat farmland.
Mm.
So you'd been 10 minutes from downtown if you'd put it over there. But the international complications were just too much, so you just never made it work.
So you decided on the location out of the metro?
No, the big aircraft or airplane expert in our family is my sister, Sammy, who she was a licensed commercial flyer. She flew during the war in the WASP and ferrying V-20.
That's her nickname. What's her?
Well, her name is Sarah Ann.
Sarah Ann.
And she now is married to a guy named Chuck Winston.
Uh-huh. Name is Winston. Are they in this area?
No, they live in Harbor Point in the summertime and Delray in the wintertime.
Is she still flying?
Not lately. I don't think so. I think she still has her license, but
she had
you know, literally multi-engine, unlimited, et cetera, and thousands of hours, and was a and used to race.
But your aviation experience was technically as a passenger.
Oh yeah,
but you were
absolutely
very much devoted to to the advancement of aviation.
I was, you know, it's like everything else. It was something that at that time in Detroit was quite an active issue, and I had a lot of friends, Bill Joy and so on, that had airports or airplanes, and my sister was, she ran the whole aircraft operation for Essex Wire. She had about five or six pilots working for her, and she was the chief pilot. And flew the chairman around, and they had an assortment of airplanes. And she's quite an accomplished young lady.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it got to the point where you'd come into if she and I were flying together, you'd come into some airport, and she'd call in, and they'd say, "Hi, Sammy." They knew right away who it was. The tower did. Yeah.
Well, one more thought about spring. If as Dick Langworth says, Bates left his. Left his mark on the company with the making the Terraplane a lusty symbol of the company's strength and importance. Wouldn't you say that that Frank Spring certainly was the man who made it a good looking and
good
kind of drive.
He had a great eye. He had fastidious taste, in my opinion. I mean, if he said a line was correct on an automobile, you can pretty much figure it was.
Yeah.
And in fact, I can remember subsequently when after the Nash Hudson merger, we used to look at the modifications that were then the product of the company over at the Hudson Styling Studio, and George Mason would. We'd have a meeting there every Friday, and I would be invited, mostly because I was one of the few Hudson residues, you might say, and of course Frank was not there; he'd left the company by that time,
mm-hmm.
and Mason would look at the car and there'd be a molding that didn't look right, and he'd say to me, you know, what do you think about that? And everybody'd have an opinion, and I could say to myself, Jesus, we just had Spring here; he had that whole thing. He'd never even let him show it like that,
right? Yeah.
But George was pretty smart. We'd have that meeting on Friday morning early, and about maybe 9 o'clock or 9:30, he'd say, "Well, Roy, why don't you decide anything that you think from the Hudson point of view, and so and so, you'd handle it." And he'd be out the door because City Airport was just up the street, and in 30 minutes he was in the air on his way up to Grayling.
Oh, that was his favorite spot.
Yeah, that was his fishing camp. It was. I could never figure out why we always had for about twice. I didn't realize why we always had the meetings early Friday morning, but then I figured it out.
Was your interest gravitated toward engineering and sales, but were you also interested in design? I suspect you had a.
Yeah.
You picked up
yeah.
I think
I had a fairly decent eye for what something ought to look like.
Yeah.
And
were you happy with the designs of the 30s?
Yes. You know, I thought the 32 Hudson and Essex were absolutely classic automobiles.
Right.
And my father was very interested in it, too. For example, we had one of the first wood grain instrument panels in, I think it was the 32 Hudson. Yeah. Which, where the whole panel, and the panel, the wood graining itself, which you know is done with a photographic process, was taken by, my father took a board, a leaf, out of our dining room table at home and had him photograph that because it had the perfectly magnificent grain on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the instrument panel decor for the, it was the 32 Hudson. It didn't get nearly as much play, those two cars, as did the Terraplane, because of the economic situation. The Terraplane was the lowest priced automobile in the line, and et cetera. But it was they were classic automobiles, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, too, I think that everything was in good taste. And of course, and they were very successful. That Terraplane had a certain spirit to it that typical of the touch that Frank had.
Mm-hmm. The Essex was phased out within a few years, wasn't it?
The Terraplane originally was called the Essex Terraplane in 1932, mm-hmm. and I think by 33 it they dropped the Essex name, and then by 34 they had actually, in effect, discontinued the Terraplane. They had another...
You mean the Essex?
No, they actually discontinued it. They used the name Terraplane on a completely different automobile.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, it didn't even look like a Terraplane
yeah.
in 34.
Mm-hmm.
And that was carried over into 35, mm-hmm. and then that was revised. By 36, the Terraplane name was gone.
Yes, that's right.
And it was then called...
Hudson 8?
It was called a Hudson, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you went into sales early on. Do you remember working for W.R. Tracy, the vice president of sales in those days?
No, I never worked for him. I remember him.
Yeah.
But he was gone by the time I didn't actually get into sales until after the war.
Oh, after the war.
I was 40.
You were pretty much in engineering.
Yeah. I was in production through the war.
Production.
And. And it was right after the war, 46, I remember they sent me to Chicago to work in the Chicago zone, so-called, as a district manager. And I remember distinctly because it was just almost impossible to find a place to live. I had a hell of a job finding a place to live in Chicago, but I finally succeeded. And it was the days of rent control.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget this. I won't make a story out of it. It's a long story. But my wife and I moved over there. And we left our children here. We had two children at that time, and with a nurse, and kept the house here. And
mm-hmm.
finding a place to live, you know, you could stay in the, I stayed in the, what is now the Hilton Hotel for about 2 weeks, which then they kicked us out. And anyway, to make a long story short, we were looking, so we got wind that there was an apartment available in the Ambassador East, which was, you know, a very fine hotel in north side of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew a woman who was sort of responsible for the rentals there. And she said, I can get you an introduction to the owners. I'll take you in and let you talk to them. But she said, they're going to Europe for the next 6 months, but there's no way you're going to get that apartment rented. So I said, well, okay, we'll take a shot at it. So we went in our best demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking to the name was Foreman. They had a beautiful corner apartment with a living room and a little kitchen and so on, a bedroom, just what we needed. The woman said, well, I'm really sorry, there's no way we're going to do this, but, you know, and I hate to disappoint you, and so on and so forth. But she said, but if you'd like to see, I'll show you our bedroom. And in the bedroom, there's a picture of this boy. And I said, are you John Foreman's mother?
Oh.
And she said, yes. I said, John and I were in school together. We're good friends. She said,
yeah.
She looked at, no, this was at Los Alamos Ranch School in New Mexico.
Oh, New Mexico, yeah. Yes, right.
And she looked at me suspiciously. She said, John happens to be right here in Winnetka. Let's call him up. Thinking she really had me nailed. That I had. So we called him up, and I said, John, this is Roy Chapin. He said, well, you old son of a bitch.
was she on the
And she's listening all the while. You know?
Oh, that's
and anyway, that's how we got the apartment. And it was, I never forget, it was $125 a month. For one of these, you know, you'd pay that a day now in the Ambassador East. In fact, for half a day, maybe.
Half a day, probably.
Well, anyway, that's the reason I remember
so
when it was.
John,
his father had the Foreman National Bank in Chicago, which has now been absorbed by who knows. I expect. Yeah, and John was their son, who had not been all that long, but I had known. He was out at Los Alamos for a period, he was instrumental in getting me a place to live.
Have you kept in touch over the years?
No.
No,
sorry
yeah.
to say, I have no idea what happened.
Yeah.
We never were really good friends. We just—he was one of these. Well, anyway, it worked out. that was the beginning of the sales operation,
mm-hmm.
and I stayed in sales from there and then up until the merger.
Well, 1940, according to what I see here, as you say, the Terraplane line had been phased out, and you had a completely restyled line.
Yeah.
I noted some of the advertising they called symphonic styling, very clean, attractive, and very derivative, but of the best features of some really nice cars.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Well, we went through a period. Well, that had to do with the... I think, if I remember, and I think I do, mm-hmm. symphonic styling really meant that they had, that there were a number of interior trims which, instead of having everything gray or everything tan or everything mm-hmm. whatever, that you could combine with certain with the exteriors.
Ah.
So that there was the two.
Symphony of colors.
They complemented or one another rather than clashing. And that was really what it got down to. And I think the instrument panels were painted the same color, you know, that kind of stuff. But the thing we tried to do during that period, because the 40, 41, 42, and after the war, the 46 and 7 cars were all basically the same cars. We changed a few little things. We took the running boards off and a couple things like that. But we went through a period of trying to sell safety.
Mm-hmm.
Which must have been around 40, 41 in there.
One of the very earliest
yeah.
on that, I think.
And, you know, and then there were a lot of, you know, saleable items on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how many cars safety sold has always been a favorite topic of dispute
oh, yeah.
or discussion
yeah.
in the industry.
Right.
But Hudson did have quite a few, had a whole list of so-called firsts. And some of them weren't exactly earth-shaking, but for example, the hood was hinged in the front so that you could raise the back, but I mean, the theory was it couldn't blow open in your face.
Mm-hmm.
There was a follow-up system mechanically on the brake pedal so that if the hydraulics went out, it would then engage what is the parking brake, which was just a mechanical system to the rear brakes.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work very damn well, but at least you didn't put your foot to the floor and have nothing happen.
Right.
You didn't stop right away, but at least you slowed down.
Which happens so often.
Yeah. And there were
cars,
a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That they had a fluid cushion clutch in Hudson, which was really a very nice clutch if you kept it in shape. But if you'd let the fluid go, you lost your clutch.
Mm-hmm.
And there were things like that. That pinned piston rings, which was a big deal then, and there's a list somewhere of about 100 some odd things that are, and some of which are very minor, like the ashtrays, you know, different location or something like that.
You mentioned that fully independent front suspension was used.
Yeah.
And with wishbones, a coil spring and telescopic shock absorbers inside the coil spring.
That sounds like Nash. What's the deal?
No, this is 40. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee, that's. Because we had semi-elliptics as long as I can remember.
Hmm.
I think somebody got a little confused there.
Apparently also that year we'll check on that. Apparently also that year you went back full into racing, apparently.
To what?
Went back into racing, apparently. Well, at least into
40,
speed
trials.
Stop,
speed yeah, trials. Yeah, because we had a good V8 engine.
Yeah.
And we discovered that we could do things out on the salt flats
mm-hmm.
with it. We had some.
John Cobb, I believe, was one of your drivers.
Yeah. And Reed Railton's kind of got us started again on that, I think. Did you know?
R-A-I-L-T-O-N.
Reed. He was an Englishman who modified Hudsons during the 20s and made really spectacular sports cars, and for that matter, spectacular town cars.
Mm.
He made them very British. And in fact, I drove one of his sports cars at the Brooklands track. That there was a famous picture that used to see in a lot of magazines of it coming over a hill, and literally all four wheels 3-4 feet off the ground, and the gentleman sitting there with a pipe clenched in his teeth. It's the most perfectly British photograph you ever saw in your life. A little cap on it, a pipe in his teeth. He's all four wheels off the ground. It's a priceless picture. I wish I could remember. That would have been about 1927 or 8, along in there,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
early 30s, maybe.
Also, the Miller brothers, too.
Well, that's what I mentioned. Chet and Al Miller were test drivers at the same time I was.
Yeah.
You know. Al used to have a little filling station up around Grayling, that one was right in the thumb, was right in
Mid City.
That way up north, he had a little spot by the side of the road, and I always used to stop in there and chew the fat with him, and he was a great fellow. He'd lost a leg, but he still could drive. He could drive with one foot.
Well, the Hudson 8 became well known for its speed trials.
Yes, they've set hundreds of records.
Literally 121.
Yeah.
Right. Well, apparently, according to this chronology, you lost money in 40, but in 1941 was a very good year, apparently.
Yes, we made money in 41.
Up close to 4 million.
Was it?
Yeah, 3.7.
And then, as I say, the war came on, and from, I think, 40, well, we had a 42 model, and then I guess...
Very briefly.
That, yeah, and then that's when we converted everything during 42.
What was your role in the war material?
Well, originally I was... I was the... I've forgotten the exact sequence now. I was the production planning manager for the... the assistant production planning manager for the... aircraft division,
mm-hmm.
And then they got in trouble with the government, not because of any fault of ours, but we couldn't get what they called GFE, government furnished equipment, which was all, you know, what we were building was the aft section of the fuselage for the B-26, and the wings for the B-26,
mm-hmm.
And Chrysler built the forward section, and Goodyear made the middle section, and we shipped it all out to Martin in Omaha, where they stuck it all together in an airplane,
mm-hmm.
And subsequently we did the same thing for the B-29s,
mm-hmm.
And in fact the B-29 that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima was built, pieces were built by us,
really?
As it happened,
mm-hmm.
I have a little plaque to that effect.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And anyway, the point that I moved, and I'm not sure the sequence exactly, I moved into the contracts division because they couldn't get out of Wright Field all the stuff we needed to build the airplane. We were
mm-hmm.
holding up production because it's not our fault, but because the government didn't. So they said to me, you go down and get this stuff sprung loose.
But Wright Field was kind of a bottleneck in the early part of the
world. In our case, it
yeah.
was.
Mm-hmm.
I went down there and spent a lot of time down there. I just literally, I got to know a couple of the sergeants, and I'd go right out in the warehouse, and sometimes I'd help them find stuff, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And but having somebody on the spot expedited, if it's a question, do we ship this to Chrysler or to Hudson? Why, if I was right there, it probably went to Hudson. And so I worked in the contract section. I was the assistant contract officer for a while. And then I went back, when we got the B-29 contract, I went back in as the assistant, what the hell did he call it? I was the assistant general superintendent, whatever it was. I was
mm-hmm.
the next to the number two guy running the operation.
Right.
And
the headquarters were still on?
Still out in Detroit. I mean, right out on Jefferson Avenue.
Jefferson Avenue,
yeah.
Big
yeah.
plant there, yeah.
And in fact, I was about to be, without going into a lot of detail, they decided maybe I ought to be drafted. This is getting toward the end of the war.
Yes, right. Well, how'd that happen?
Let's just say our contracting officer, I better not put this in the record, was not a fellow that I had great admiration for. And we were at cross purposes because I thought he was screwing things up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just plain didn't tell him things. And in fact, in any case, he decided maybe I was a thorn in his side and he was going to get rid of me.
Mm.
And now this is hypothesis, because obviously I can't prove it, but all of a sudden, out of nowhere, came a draft notice. And so I went down and I had my physical and all that stuff, and I was in fine shape. I was, I don't know how old I was, but I was young enough. I had three kids, but in any case, I was headed for the infantry. And or some menial job somewhere, and Wright Field found out about it, and they came down like a brick. They just they transferred the contracting officer and a few other things, and said this guy stays right where he is.
Good.
So that's the extent of my military career.
Believe me, you would have been wasted, I think, menial.
Well, fortunately, they seem to feel the same way, because there were a lot of temptations. Of course, you know, in the beginning of the war, there were all kinds of opportunities to go into various really exciting things, but anyhow.
You may not have survived.
But true.
You also did some work for Helldivers and Aero Cobras, too.
Yeah, we made wings for the AT-6, I think it was called, and the Navy version of it, which I think was the...
And the Bell Aero Cobra, which was an early fighter, as I recall.
Yeah.
You also did landing craft engines, mine anchors, and naval guns. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was all done at the so-called Naval Ordnance Plants. Which was out in Warren, and that's the one that I went out there, but I had nothing to do with it. It was run like a separate company. Bates was sent out there to take it over, and he ran the whole damn thing. And I never even saw him during the war, practically.
Yeah.
Northrop was in charge of the, and Barrett, and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm. an exciting time for you.
It was a frustrating time because, you know, well, you worked 7 days a week and about 10 hours a day. And the frustrating part was the caliber of the people that you had to work with. Because, you know, aircraft, even then, was a fairly precise business. I mean, you couldn't say, well, that's only a quarter inch out, so don't worry about it. And we got the dregs of the labor market, mostly women. And without going any farther in, but ones that you'd give them a wrench that just fit the nut, let's say, and you'd come back an hour later and they had a pair of pliers tightening the nut, this kind of stuff, which it was just unbelievable. And it used to drive me crazy because I'm a Virgo and that kind of stuff. But it was, it drove everybody else crazy too.
The exterior lies a restless
An expectation that you do things right. Say, and so that was pretty that kind of thing, and believe it or not, we even had to fight the union on some things.
Yes, yeah, that was great.
That was one of the jobs I frankly liked the least, and I got it though, which is and it wasn't really a negotiation. In those days, a lot of it was just plain almost name calling,
right,
and I'd try to kind of keep things on a. But anyway, I was damn glad when the war was over, let's put it that way.
Well, you're in good position as the war ends. You've got a couple of years of facelifts, and of course the public will buy anything you put out. So you're
even with wooden bumpers and no rear seats and really a few other things like that. Oh, yeah, we shipped them to get them out. and people were so glad to get them, they didn't give a damn.
No.
And sooner or later you'd send the bumpers to them.
So you replated the front for 46, and
changed the grill
a bit.
Took the running boards off.
But you were poised, as everybody else was, for a really marvelous post-war push. Do you remember any details on that? You were probably in the thick of that.
Well, the only details is it was purely a seller's market.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was so-called regional, or what they call a district manager, which means a guy who is the lowest form of animal life in the automobile business,
right,
in the sales end. And you have about, I had about, say, 20 dealers.
You take all the heat and none of the credit.
But in those days, all you were was a car distributor. You just allocated them. I was thoroughly conscious of the fact I wasn't selling anything, but what you were doing was selling accessories. You sold them everything down to lace pillows to put in the back seat.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And, well, practically. Well, actually, there was a package like that. But, God, it included electric shavers and hydraulic jacks, and you sold all that junk. But it wasn't junk. I mean, it was all useful stuff, but it was the added little thing that was the only thing you had to sell, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I developed some techniques for that worked out fairly well.
Oh, really? Any that you'd like to go on record with?
This is a little later. When I was a district manager in Chicago, I had everything from South Chicago down to Champaign, Urbana,
mm-hmm.
I'd get down to Champaign on Sunday night, and I'd work my way back north and try to get to South Chicago along about Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I really enjoyed about it was you had to be two completely different people.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be one kind of a guy in Champaign,
mm-hmm.
or Kankakee, let's say.
Yeah.
And by the time you got to Blue Island in South Chicago and Cicero, you had to be an entirely different kind of a guy. And I really enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
But
multiple roles to play.
Yeah, well, because you were dealing with entirely different kind of people. And from that I graduated to what we called a regional manager. In those days, Hudson still had distributors,
mm-hmm.
and each distributor had a big retail operation of his own, but then he had from around 15 or 20 dealers in his particular territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Cleveland, Akron, Columbus, Toledo, Detroit, Saginaw, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, South Bend, which was a hell of a big region,
mm-hmm.
but geographically it was fairly compact. And to make a long story short, my job was to sell the distributor on all these packages of items of equipment, from polish to radios,
mm-hmm.
and which all were not factory installed. And he would buy them, and then he'd resell them to his dealers. And I discovered an absolutely wonderful technique, which was I put down a whole lot of have it typed up very official, the quotas for each distributor, but I'd double them all. And I'd leave it on the desk when I would get my papers, and inevitably this guy would come around and look at it.
Of course.
The principal, I'd arrange it so that I'd be out of the office or something, and he'd look at it. And he'd think he was awful sharp if he only had to take two-thirds of his so-called quota, because I'd tell him what the quota was.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I was always selling about 50% more than my absolute necessity. At least I always at least met my quota, let's say.
Anybody catch on to that technique? Did you recall?
Nobody ever admitted that they'd caught on, because they'd have had that. Had to, I guess, think that they were pretty stupid to have bought it in the first place. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, it was not a very subtle technique. But it was one that I had very few returns, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And that led then to another period of the career, which I don't know whether you want to talk about that.
Well,
yet.
Do, yes.
Well, I that worked out pretty well. Those fellows were quite successful. But then we decided to turn to direct operations, meaning zones, which mm-hmm. are factory owned and
yes.
factory operated.
Right.
And that meant going to these distributors and telling, let's say, the guy in Kalamazoo and Saginaw and Grand Rapids and Toledo and so on, they're going to be under the Detroit zone. And I got the job of going around and setting up zones, meaning mm-hmm. getting... finding the building and getting somebody to operate it. And we had our own people normally, you know, we just brought in. But then you had to go around and convince these guys that they should stay on as retail operators and should operate, but they would no longer have any wholesale responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little sticky because, while they all knew it was coming, we were in some ways maybe the last in the industry to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, they'd had a way of life for years that, and some of them were really extremely successful, very top-notch business people. Like up in New England, we had a company called Henley Kimball that had Maine, they had all New England,
mm-hmm.
and they have headquarters in Boston, a magnificent building on Commonwealth Boulevard, and all that kind of stuff.
Who
were the distributors? And Fred Ordway, that ran it, was a good personal friend of mine, as it happened, and I had to go break the news to him that he was out,
mm-hmm.
and he had four branches, Worcester and so on and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
And that was a tough period because, you know, you hate to, although, as I say, these guys were realists. They knew it was coming, and they just wanted to make the best deal that they could out of it. But then there was a lot of loyalty to those people, too, on the part of their dealers. And you had to, in a sense, you had to overcome that, so you had to go around and talk to a lot of dealers, too. And
obviously, you were very good at
this. Well, I don't know, but at least they kept me on the job. I enjoyed it only mostly because it was a challenge, but it meant living in a lot of different parts of the country, as a result of which I ran a number of zones when we didn't have a really qualified zone manager. That I just stayed someplace for 2 or 3 months and run it until we got somebody to take it over. And
this one, your family still in Chicago, or you moved to
Detroit? No, I moved along back. When I got to be the regional manager, having all those distributors, I moved right back to Grosse Pointe and stayed there. But I'd go and stay maybe 2 months in Boston or 3 months or Philadelphia or wherever,
mm-hmm.
and I enjoyed it because it was new, something new and different every day.
Oh yes, it must
be exciting. It was a little wearing because there was a lot of travel.
But sales, and especially that kind of generating and regenerating process that you had, where it was the lifeblood of the industry.
Yeah. And then subsequently, I was the guy who went around and did territory analysis, where you go in and you look at it, and then you say, we got too many dealers here and not enough over here, and that kind
mm-hmm.
of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll just tell you an interesting little anecdote. I was sent out to San Francisco because the distributor there had sort of messed it up.
Mm-hmm.
And he had put one little guy in, and the whole place was a storefront operation. It was just a nothing thing, and he was really just getting under the hide of a good big dealer whom we really needed to protect. So, to make a long story short, I wrote a report on the trip and I sent it to Vandersee, who was the vice president of sales, my boss, and I very delicately, Norman Vandersee,
Vandersee,
you know, his brother was the sales manager for Chrysler, Abe Vandersee.
Right.
Anyway, I wrote a rather discreet report suggesting that this fellow's mislocated and so on. And Vandersee sent it back to me saying, just what do you mean? And I wrote in the margin, cancel the son of a bitch. And unfortunately, He sued us.
Oh,
we
no.
did cancel him. He
yeah.
sued us, and they got all the his lawyers
mm-hmm.
Got a requisition or whatever you call it, all the papers on the case, and then included in the file, of course, was this with my note. Well,
Energy hadn't destroyed it.
No, he stuck it in his file, and we lost the suit. It's the only one we ever lost. And I was in San Francisco for nearly a month as a witness of this thing, and it was unbeatable. He was a little guy physically,
mm-hmm.
and a little meek little guy, and he literally came into the court with an American flag in his hand,
oh,
and he brought his wife and his kid,
oh,
and you know, and here's this monster company grinding this poor little fellow under his heel.
Jury trial, of course.
Yes, and our lawyer, who was a young guy at that time, is now the head of the biggest law firm in San Francisco, and I see him quite frequently. I say, Jack, I hope we never have another trial like that one. He said, me too. it was one of the few black marks on his reputation. But anyway.